Welcome, Red Eyes members. Thank you very much for joining us. It's great to have you here. We are continuing here our discussion with Robert Newman, and we are, of course, talking about Mozart, I should say, Amadeus Mozart. And we are going to continue talking more about his life, how this has been constructed, put together. We're going to talk a little bit more about his death and many other things here, and I'm really looking forward to diving into some more of these questions that have come up here along the way, Robert, as we have been speaking. And the first thing I guess I'd like to talk just briefly about is you mentioned Prague at the end of our first segment and the potential importance of Prague. I know that there is a concert house in Prague which is quite prominent. I think they even have two sphinxes outside their fancy concert hall, as it were. Do you know the significance of Prague in all of this and why this has become an important area?
What a great question. What a tremendous question. You know, there are two main cities in the career of Mozart. One of them was Vienna, and the other one was Prague. Of course, Salzburg. But without Prague, there would be no Mozart today. Because in 1786, when the Marriage of Figaro failed after three performances, they withdrew it. They don't tell you that also. Mm-hmm, it was a disaster. It was a disaster. Even the newspapers of the time said it was. And it was restaged 1 year later in Prague. Now, Prague was the Jesuit center where this thing was full-scale manipulation that was going on. Prague was the city which made Mozart. It was in Prague that everyone raved about the Marriage of Figaro, and they praised this creature of Apollo, Mozart. This was the local fraternities, and he was responsible for the creation of Mozart's reputation, much more than Vienna. It was Prague partly through the Jesuits, but also through the fact that Prague was the center for many of his patrons had estates in Prague also.
Okay. A
center of Illuminati activity also.
But, well, there you go. And I've even seen pictures of where we have, if we just briefly talk about the symbolism of Prague, where you have both, Star of David's Maltese crosses mixed with each other. And it seems to be just that this is a place where a lot of different secret societies come together, and where we usually kind of see alleged, opposition against each other between these secret societies. That doesn't seem to be the case in Prague. There seems to be that everyone is coalescing and getting together there. So
well, it's rather like the elections where you have two parties who are opposed to each other, but they go to dinner with each other behind the scenes.
Yeah, there you go.
And the secret societies were simply the recruiting ground for people who would not normally have agreed with dogmatism, and so you could be seduced into these societies, whether you had beliefs of whatever beliefs you were, a Zionist or whether you were a Protestant or you were an atheist or you were a Catholic. It didn't matter. The societies would take you, and at the higher levels, you would finally find out that they're all leaning towards the center, which was, of course, the continuation, the perpetuation of the Holy Roman Empire.
Ah, that's very interesting.
And Holy Roman Empire, incidentally, which is in the process of being revived as we speak.
I'm glad you mentioned that. That's true, absolutely. Yeah.
But there, again, we are. So.
Well, exactly, with the European Union. And again, I mean, they've... Isn't that interesting, though? But they've chosen for the crown melody, I think it is, right? For the European Union anthem is Beethoven's Ode to Joy, is it right, from Beethoven?
Oh yes, I think. Absolutely. And that's funny you should mention this symbolism. When Constanze Mozart had a concert performed in honor of her late husband in Prague, I believe the year was 1704. They brought two great pyramids onto the stage, and they lit with candles, etc. Oh, it was a big thing, you know. And these things all eventually led to a very great suppression of Austrian society in the 1790s, 1800s, and this reversed all the tolerance which had been shown in the last, in the 20 years before that.
I did want to ask you about the royals throughout Europe, the touring that Leopold Mozart arranged for those 7 years, as you described in the beginning. Do you know if the royal houses throughout Europe wanted to get kind of private concerts with Mozart, like, yes, please come into our house and play for us? Do you know if that happened?
Well, the biggest communication system in Europe at that time was the post office, which was a monopoly run by the empire. Yeah, Thurn and Taxis.
Yes.
You know, this house of Thurn and Taxis was Leopold Mozart's first employer.
Really?
Yeah. Leopold Mozart's first job was with a dignitary of the Thurn and Taxis empire, which had the postal monopoly all across the Holy Roman Empire. So this was how they achieved this. It was not a problem. And that's the communication line, so that mail could be sent rapidly.
Back and forth. And yeah, well, exactly. And someone pointed out a while back that since the Tassi, Thurn and Taxi family were involved in this is why the mail system today is called the royal mail in many countries. You know,
yes.
This was the system that the royals used to communicate, and hence that's why also this is a family that would have consequently become very powerful, because they know what the royals are talking about, right? Because I think that the Thurn and Taxi from beginning wasn't a nobility family, but they were incorporated into that system where they became nobility.
Correct.
After a certain point, I think.
Correct. In fact, they moved from Frankfurt to Regensburg in the 1770s, and they continued. You're right. They married and they became, as you say, they rose in social
class, standard,
class.
Status.
Yes. Exactly. And eventually, Regensburg was a very important place for the creation of Mozart's reputation, definitely, as was Prague, but Mozart visited Regensburg in 1790, the year before he died.
And is that it in Germany, is it?
Regensburg, yes.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Okay. Well, it's really, really interesting to hear this. And again, if we talk about Leopold Mozart, the father, is there any evidence that have emerged or that you found that seems to point towards this area, that he was indeed working for someone, he was being paid, or someone was setting up this, meaning that, you know, first of all, that you mentioned in the first segment, that how did he get the money, or how did he manage to pull this off, even in regards to arranging the trips and so forth? Payments from royalty here, what do you think?
Well, there's so much falsehood in this story. The story of Mozart is that he made a lot of money for a short time, and then he had no money at the end of his life. That's the official story.
Mm.
But the real story was that he had no money all through his life. For example, in 1783-4, when he was credited with great concerts in Vienna, and he was in much demand amongst the nobility, etc. There is one letter, it still survives today, in which he's begging money from the publisher, one of the Vienna publishers, and they sent him 2 ducats. This is in 1786. It's an amazing letter, several years before the famous begging letters to Michael Puchberg at the end of his life.
Mm-hmm.
So our view of Mozart being earning lots and lots of money, he was only an actor. He was only playing the part behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm.
They would talk well of him as being a great virtuoso, and Goethe and other people were saying, well, isn't he marvelous, isn't he wonderful? But his very first opera in Vienna, Die Entführung aus dem Serail, The Abduction from the Seraglio, 1782, the very first Vienna opera of Mozart. A contemporary diarist, his name was Count Zinzendorf, noted in his diary on the day of the premiere, this music is not by Mozart.
Mm-hmm.
It is by others. Well, there you are. You see, but the mythical Viennese career of Mozart and the beginning of his, of course, if you go to the British Library now, you can see the thematic catalogue of Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. If you go to London, you can see this thematic catalogue, which began, we are told, in the year 1784, and it lasts up until his death in 1791. And in this catalogue, you can see page after page, you can see it on the internet, page after page of works that he enters into his catalogue as being composed by him. It looks very convincing, very convincing. But the only problem is, well, there are hundreds of problems, but the number one problem is the watermark on this catalogue dates from 1802.
Okay.
10 years after his death. Well, that's a small point, but I hope you agree it's significant.
It's a very significant point. That's right.
So this kind of information tends to reinforce. And then, of course, there was, on his death in 1791, were protracted negotiations for the sale of his manuscripts, which lasted from 1791 up until 1799. 8 whole years of talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
that's the official story.
I just wanted to interject here and mention that, because in the first segment, again, you mentioned about the suppression of this information. I'm also wondering if this could be, we'll see, of course, how, if at all, anyone reacts, you know, to your publication once it's out, and if someone in the mainstream dares to pick it up and so forth and challenge it or whatever. But have you noticed that there is an active suppression of this information, or is it more that people are gullible and they want to believe this, and it's a nice fair tale, so to speak, to have, so they haven't simply looked into the evidence? What do you think?
It's a combination of both. Mozart is a paradigm, and in a paradigm you go round and round in circles and you never question the assumptions on which the story is based.
Yes.
And this is the paradigm of 9/11 or the moon landings or Mozart, the myths. Civilizations cannot exist without myths. Even in the days of Socrates, you know, if you question the myths of the state, you are regarded as a heretic. You don't get funding from the big corporations. They will say, oh, we're going to withdraw our sponsorship unless you conform to the norm, the expectation. So this is what happens. Talent suppressed.
It's interesting that you mentioned that, because again, this is the idea about the prime of the species, almost in that sense. This is the pivotal point in human achievement, at least when it comes to music. Even his music is being sent on the golden disc that is being sent out into space by the Voyager craft or what have you. You know, this is like, this is what we're going to show the aliens if they arrive. Do you know what I mean?
well, in a sense, maybe it's more accurate than to send some Bach, no?
Well, there you go. Okay.
But I think the difference between, say, the great composers such as Johann Sebastian Bach is that they were not trying to be anything special. They had a job. They were writing music for that time. They were not interested in the politics of music. Bach is an altogether different type of character, and of course Bach was almost totally unknown to the Viennese. He was rediscovered, inverted commas, only in the late 18th century.
Yes, yes.
They seem to have suffered from amnesia in this century after he died. So,
well, let's talk a little bit about the death of Mozart, because again, do you consider that he was taken out, so to speak? He was fairly young in that sense. I don't know, maybe not for the time he was living in, but it feels to me that a martyr, so to speak, is always a better for the masses to kind of worship. You know, if he dies, you know, it will be more of a symbol. It becomes more of an archetypal image that people can project this upon. Would you agree?
Uh, I think the circumstances surrounding Mozart's death, I don't claim to be able to resolve them, but I have my personal opinion. I think the preponderance of the evidence suggests that he was poisoned.
Mm.
I know for sure that there are many reports to that effect of the time, including in Beethoven's conversation book notebooks people were still talking about this. Then we have the confessions of Salieri of being involved with this. Of course, these are rubbish, but the truth is that there are dozens of such accounts, even by his son, who in later years spoke of his body being bloated soon after his death. And there are lots of... There is the bungled death report. There is the fact that, contrary to popular myth, his cortege never went to the cathedral. There is no record of this at all. This was written many years later. It seems that his body was buried with great haste the day after he died, which mm-hmm. was on Monday, the 4th of December, 1791. And there is, of course, a Constanze Mozart's account that he was convinced he had been poisoned. But there are many, many other lines of evidence which seem to indicate this. However, there is also a book on the assassination of Mozart by an Italian writer which suggests that he had been killed by a jealous husband. And this is Hoftemel. This is another theory, so I wouldn't be dogmatic about this.
Okay. And what's your hunch here if we're talking about potential perpetrators of this who would have the interest of getting rid of him? You know,
I think Mozart, as the decade unfolded, there were people who knew that he was obtaining status that he didn't deserve. And there were people in Vienna who knew this, and they didn't like it. And another reason is that Mozart was, he was not discreet about his private life. He slept around a lot. He had a reputation for being a womanizer.
Mm-hmm.
After his death, in the one newspaper of the time credits Mozart with having a child by another woman, which was adopted after his death. There is one report of this. And so we have this kind of strain. But we know he was prosecuted in 17... Did you know that?
No.
Mozart was prosecuted in Vienna in 1790. But the court case, the papers of this court case, he was prosecuted by Prince Lichnowsky in 1790.
For what?
This is a very good question. For what was he prosecuted? We only have the verdict. The verdict was that his salary would be halved. This is in 1790. And there are those who believe that he had an affair with one of the Lichnowsky family. And this was the reason why they decided to make an example of him in 1790. And this court judgment, and you can see this in the Lichnowsky papers or online, you can even see this sentence, is very rarely discussed within Mozart biography. One thing is sure, he was shunned by almost all of the establishment at the time when he died. The idea of a cortege following him to the gravesite or turning back because of the weather is nonsense. It was actually a clear day on the 5th of December,
okay.
1791. So, there is so much mythology constructed around his life that it's hard. And then, of course, there is the Requiem, the affair of the idea that he died still dictating notes from the Mozart Requiem.
Mm-hmm.
This is fiction.
All right.
In 1825, an article appeared in a Vienna music journal stating that this Mozart's Requiem was a falsification. It was written by other people. There is a big article about this, but you don't hear much about this. And secondly, the commission to write a Requiem has never been seen, ever. I mean, okay. It's a piece of paper. Nobody has ever seen it.
Mm.
So But it was a fitting end. It was a fitting end in the Mozart story that he should be writing a requiem. I mean, as a loyal son of the Catholic Church, you couldn't have a better ending to the story than this. But it's fiction. And likewise, there were so many false reports surrounding his final days.
What about Beethoven's role in all of this? What's your opinion of him as a composer and his? Do you think he's genuine as well here?
It's an interesting question. In 1783, Beethoven was being compared to Mozart in an Illuminati publication of that year. But Beethoven was a pupil in Bonn, of course. And the 13-year-old Beethoven was quite a formidable pianist, even at the age of 13. But he was quickly taken under the patronage of the same people who had patronized Mozart.
Mm-hmm.
It was a fraternity. It was an industry within an industry. They controlled the industry. And Lichnowsky, the same Lichnowsky, was an early patron of Beethoven. And if you look closely into these things, you can find some strange things in the history of Beethoven. But it's a big subject, and I don't want to bore you with that. But Cartellieri, whom I mentioned before, is one of the composers who worked with Beethoven. Mm. You know the dedication on the Eroica symphony?
No.
Beethoven's third symphony is the Eroica symphony. Yeah?
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Okay, this dedication is dedicated to a hero who has recently died, and everyone thinks this dedication is to Napoleon Bonaparte.
Hmm.
But it's not Napoleon Bonaparte. The dedication came 6 years after it was finished, and this dedication was to Joseph Cartellieri. Hmm. Cartellieri was his musical colleague, and he had just died. And Beethoven wrote this, but everyone since that time has said, no. This symphony, Eroica, is all about Napoleon, but it wasn't. There are lots of things like this.
Very interesting. How about the, if we talk a little bit about, we can begin with the marriage of Figaro. Was this is something, I guess, is this a favorite piece of yours that you've really been studying more in detail than others, or is this just something that have caught your attention more because of the inconsistencies in how this was put together?
Figaro has a track record of discrepancy. One year before the premiere, there was a performance of Le Nozze di Figaro in Frankfurt, but nobody speaks about that. Figaro is high-profile Mozart, and yet has a story more complicated than more complicated than most. It made him famous, and it catapulted him to enormous fame. But it was the product of several composers.
Hmm. And is that any of the previous that you mentioned before? Do you think Van Hal or Joseph Mislavich or some of these composers?
Joseph Mislavicek died in 1781, so he wasn't involved.
Okay.
Van Hal possibly, but there were others. There were the two brothers, Paul Ranitsky, I don't know if you've heard of him.
No.
Paul Ranitsky and Anton Ranitsky. These were two Bohemian composers. One of them was employed in Bohemia, the other one was in Vienna. Paul Ranitsky was in Vienna, and it's almost certain that he was involved in the creation of this opera. If you listen to his music, it's astonishingly similar to Mozart's.
Really? That's interesting.
Yes. Yeah. The first opera that was staged after Mozart's death was an opera by Paul Ranitsky, Oberon, which was the most popular opera in Vienna for 30 years. And yet today, nobody's ever made a recording of it. Can you imagine that?
Hmm.
The most popular opera in the whole of Viennese musical history is Oberon by Paul Wimitsky. And yet you will look in vain to find a recording of this.
That's right.
Yeah, you should check it out.
How about the magic flute? And again, this is one that many have looked upon as having Freemasonic symbolism, the initiation ritual are potentially interwoven in here. What's your take on all that? Is that also kind of a crowning achievement, you think? And this is something that the controllers wanted to have in there?
Well, the marriage of the magic flute has an interesting history. It's really the fusion of all of the fraternities, the fusion, the culmination point, if you like, of everything that they had worked for. It was Mozart's last big public opera. It wasn't his last opera. His last opera was La Clemenza di Tito, but that was an opera seria. It was his last public opera. And the thing about the magic flute is that it is a Rosicrucian opera. The chemical wedding.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
chemical wedding, yeah.
If you look at the chemical wedding and the marriage, there's even a book on this subject written by a German 4 years ago. It was a Rosicrucian opera, but it was also an Illuminati opera. And it was also a Jesuit opera.
Okay.
Can you imagine all of these things are to be found within here? And the text, I don't know if you know the man's name, but the man who's credited with writing the text for the magic flute was named Giesecke. Giesecke.
How do you spell that?
G-I-E. S-E-K-E. Giesecke. Giesecke.
Right, yeah.
Giesecke is a very interesting character because he finally disappeared from Vienna very suddenly. He was Illuminati. Giesecke was Illuminati. And he came and lived in Dublin. He eventually became a teacher of geology, believe it or not, in Dublin. And he disappeared. He changed his name and everything. It was only recently that people found out about him. And he was close friends of the Vienna music publisher Hofmeister, who was also Illuminati, and a very important publisher in the career of Mozart. Anyway, Giesecke was friendly with back in Salzburg, and it was a camaraderie, it was a fraternity. And so the story of the magic flute, and there's one final thing I can say, is that the music score of the magic flute before the first premiere was sent back to Bonn so that it could be repaired and improved.
Really?
We have the Yes. We have the musical evidence for this. It's already contained in the correspondence of the Bonn publishers, Simrock. Simrock was a publisher. And one of his letters, 20 years after Mozart's death, agrees that this opera was sent to Bonn, even before the premiere. So really what you're hearing is, once again, highly suppressed.
And Simrock, is that a last name or the name for the publisher, or what is it?
Simrock was an Illuminati publisher who was based in Bonn.
Okay.
Based in Bonn.
And again, just to ask you quickly here regarding the magic flute, that this is a kind of a fusion then of all the secret societies, their initiation, that this is a kind of, bringing all of these different elements and secret societies to kind of together in this marriage in that sense. Do you think that is then a kind of communication or is it like a crowning achievement that, yeah, this is what we're striving for here. We know that we're separate groups right now, but really behind the scenes, it's actually one group in that sense.
Exactly. It was the end of the project, if you like. It was the last, it was the convergence of all these disparate elements to sustain the status quo.
Absolutely.
It's a remarkable story. But then Don Giovanni is a remarkable story also.
Sure.
who could think of writing an opera which is permanently nighttime?
Hmm.
Yeah? If you look at the plot of Don Giovanni, there's no daylight. It's all set in the nighttime.
Okay. What does that tell you? What do you think that they're trying to convey there?
By this time, the career of Mozart meant different things to different people. These were the fraternities, and this was their propaganda. This was their moment to savor. But this music that appears on the surface to be frivolous and of no consequence had a deeper meaning. They wanted it to be that way. They wanted these operas to be written like this. I'm not saying that the Illuminati are some vague organization. They work to very specific ends. They wanted control, and they obtained control of publishing in Vienna. By 1783, all publishers in Vienna were under the control of the Illuminati.
Do you consider, if you also kind of interweave the Illuminati in here, do you feel, or do you rather consider it to be anti-royal, as some are saying, or do you think that, again, this is just a veil and something on the surface, and that, again, if you go far enough behind the scenes or behind the veil, so to speak, or far enough up the ladder, that royalty is as interconnected with the revolutionary philosophy of bringing down the monarchy? What do you think that the source here is, so to speak?
I think that is a brilliant question. Well, an absolutely brilliant question. That there are two different threads. One of them is the British Empire. British Empire, the British banking system, which came from Venice. It was Venice where so much of the hidden history comes from. Mm. Venice and the cultivation of the of Britain as an empire, all funded from the beginning of the Bank of England and all of these things.
Right, the money, the wealth, even Queen Victoria has roots back to the Venetians, right?
Exactly. And then there was the other thread is that of the straightforward revival of the Catholic dominance of Europe, the Holy Roman Empire. And eventually one of them merged into the other, so that the Holy Roman Empire at the time of the Congress of Vienna was done away with. But what was not done away with was the power of the monarchy, the power of the elite families, etc. This continued. And yes, the British monarchy has a great deal to do with Mozart's reputation. Certainly, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Queen Charlotte, I don't know if you've heard of Queen Charlotte.
Yes.
George III's wife.
Mm-hmm. Yeah?
Yeah. George III's wife, he never met her until the day that they married. That was how arranged it was.
Right, yeah.
It was at that time that the fraternities in England could virtually manipulate history, and they did so. Through Freemasonry, looked accessible to everybody. Nobody who would realize that at the top of this tree were the same deep-seated conservatism that you find in every other fraternity.
So again, it's that idea of also about the controlled opposition, so to speak, to get people involved in what seemed to be on the surface anti-monarchy or whatever.
Yes, that's exactly. You can see this in the French Revolution. When the French Revolution took place, why did it take place? It took place because it was convenient to take place. Napoleon was created by the Jesuits to punish the nations which had banned the Jesuit order in 1773. It took time. But they finally destroyed, they wreaked havoc on France. They wreaked Robespierre, the Knight of Terror.
Yes.
He was a Jesuit-educated evil man. Robespierre.
Right.
The man who brought in these executions. Check it out.
Yeah.
The French Revolution was not just all about democracy and liberty forth. It was the transition from the feudal system. They knew that things had to change, and to revive their interest, they had to restore the Jesuits. And that is exactly what Napoleon achieved. Napoleon was created from Corsica, the place where the Jesuits had been banished. As you, if you read your history, you know this.
Yes.
They came from Corsica, and that is why there is a relationship between Mozart, the career of Mozart, and the Napoleonic period, which later it's like they ride both horses at the same time. The white horse rider becomes the red horse rider. It's the same rider, but different horses.
Yes, yes. And
this is the manipulation of history.
And I think that you mentioned there at the beginning that Maynard Solomon is a source that people can go to check out some of this as well. Then is that right, or is he also part of helping to contribute to the myth about Mozart?
I think that you have to gather pieces from wherever you can find them.
Mm.
Sometimes, Solomon was just a good writer, but this is one source. I can give you hundreds of sources on. For example, there are documents today. If you go to Regensburg in Germany, you can see a copy of the Paris Symphony of Mozart, called by Mozart, which has his name written on top of another person's name, the true composer of this piece of music.
Okay. Is it decodable, so to speak? Can one see what name is beneath there?
Yes, the name is Lucchesi, who was the Kapellmeister of Bonn. But Lucchesi has been airbrushed out of history. You never hear about Andrea Lucchesi. He was Beethoven's teacher for 20 years.
Hmm.
But if you read the famous biographies of Mozart, you never hear a single reference to Andrea Lucchesi, Italian, because he was an Italian Kapellmeister. He has been airbrushed completely out of German textbooks on music history. Andrea Lucchesi, yet another composer who is not convenient to talk about, you see, because he supported Mozart's career, and therefore he has to be airbrushed out of history, lost today, lost completely. Such an important person, and yet he was writing music for Mozart, the Paris Symphony, K-297. This is by Lucchesi.
Do you think that many pieces then have been lost to history, so to speak, or are we still getting the music of the time through the name of Mozart from many of these other composers, or do you think that they've censored material at that period as well?
There are several thousand symphonies, but we hear only from a few, and in that sense, and of course then there is the problem of the origins of this music. The sheer dominance of Italian musicians is hardly appreciated today. We have this belief that people are born with these natural talents, and this is grotesque. How can Mozart be a model for aspiring musicians when he never studied music?
Well, exactly. This is a very, very good point that you bring up there, because it's something that becomes unattainable. It's almost like it's sending the message to people: don't even try it, because you have to be a genius from when you're 5 years old if you want to try to make it in this field. You know.
Exactly. This is what Bach said. Bach said, you have to work hard. There is no other way. You have to work hard.
Yeah.
But the belief that you can be born with this prodigious gift and write an opera before breakfast, and that's it.
And really, in one sense, and that might sound, maybe a bit difficult or whatever, but the idea that what is the achievement then really, in one sense, if he hasn't really worked for it, if it just kind of flows through him, then Mozart really hasn't, what has he done really in that sense? He's more like a conduit of something higher or more above him, which is beautiful, of course, which has this, which is in itself almost like divine in that sense. It's something that really is, people are touched by emotionally, et cetera, et cetera. So it's still important, so to speak, what he conveys, but he as a person really has nothing to do with it, right? The material.
Absolutely. I have had conversations with musicologists who despair that musicology as such can exist in the modern time.
Okay.
They despair because things like the iconic status of Mozart seems impregnable. It's almost oh, we can't study that, you know, that's too high, you know, that's too... And the truth is, of course, that over time, everything, all truth, eventually must come to the surface. And here in the case of Mozart, it's that way. And I've been in discussions, debates with other people. They said, no, Robert, you can't be right. It's wrong. But I've presented only some, you know, 2-3% of the total evidence.
Hmm. So are you in the process still of compiling, doing research and building the image, or have you pretty much got the picture set? What's going on right now?
I've got the picture set now, and I would be happy to answer questions from anyone, whatever, on whatever subject. I can't say I will have the answer, but I have, I think, sufficient evidence to say that beyond reasonable doubt, the career of Mozart was manufactured.
What do you think this, or if we say turn it on its head, is your main interest here just to get the truth out here about this man, or do you have another idea about why you want to convey this or relay this information?
I think what is true of me, I love music, and I think that the lack of integrity that you find these days in talking about history is as true of music as it is of almost everything else. And it just so happens that I was favored, or I had the opportunity to look at these things in detail. Other people, maybe they didn't have this chance. But as to what people's reaction will be to this, I don't know. Do people really want to know?
Mm-hmm.
I sometimes you ask yourself that question.
Sure.
You know, you're putting out these things. Your great website is examining many great subjects. And there are times when you wonder, do people really want to know?
Yes.
And that's always a good question.
It is. Know? Well, exactly. And people should have it in the back of their heads. And again, it's a personal choice, of course, as well, and I'm very grateful for people like you who do the research that brings another perspective, another possibility to the story that we're given, and makes people, well, again, question everything and consider everything and think twice about everything and don't take everything for granted, because so much of the stuff in history are just given to us in that sense, so we don't have the source material, the resources, and even some cases, the time as well to go into depth in all of this stuff and go in and study it. So I think it's a real, really good job here. Yeah.
If I might just ask you one question, if I may, I know you're asking me about Mozart, but I wanted to ask your opinion. What is your thinking about the best way to tackle, the best way to talk about conspiracy? Because conspiracy is regarded as, it's territory that people don't want to talk about.
Yes.
The idea that conspiracies exist, we are so programmed to believe that we're not allowed to talk about conspiracy.
Yes.
Isn't it one of the most frustrating things about life is to deny that conspiracies are a major factor in human history?
Well, absolutely. And I guess that I'm very kind of black and white when it comes to this issue, really. I think it's... You cannot ever really kind of convince someone, because there has to be a genuine interest by the person who is listening or that you're debating with, and either they will be have a susceptibility to the information and at least consider it. That doesn't mean that they have to swallow it and believe everything that they're hearing and so forth, but just the idea that, okay, let's entertain this for a while and take it into my own worldview and consider it. And I think that interest must be there. And at that point, maybe they can begin to make real judgment, so to speak, about, okay, does this fit into the larger context? And what do I have to change, so to speak, in order to incorporate this into my worldview? So I think really that it isn't about convincing anyone, really, in that sense, because there has to be an initial spark there in all these subjects, be it conspiracy, history, whatever it is. Where they have a questioning nature and just a curiosity for this type of subject. That's my belief.
Yes. Very, very interesting indeed. But after Mozart's death, the next few decades were busily spent in arriving at the final version of Mozart's inverted commas manuscripts, mm-hmm. and the publication of these completed manuscripts. But that's another huge story, and it involved several publishers, one of them in Offenbach, which was not far from Frankfurt, by André, the man who purchased these manuscripts. And then there was the creation of brand new works, which were still being included in his list up until Ludwig Kerschel finally published the Kerschel catalog that people consult today. That was in the 1850s, 1860s.
Is there like an institution or a certain group that is dedicated to kind of care for the work of Mozart and try to like, yes, this is an accepted work by him and now we make it so? Or how, do you know how that world looks, so to speak?
Yes, the Mozarteum in Salzburg is devoted to the study of Mozart and his legacy. And these are regarded as the authoritative body for the study and dissemination of information about Mozart. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there are editions of the catalogue of Mozart's works, known as the Kerschel catalogue. This is published sometimes every 10 years, every 50. There's a new edition just about to be published, the 8th edition. And so these two things are perhaps the voice of orthodoxy or the voice of convention as far as Mozart's career is concerned.
And have they been adding then concerts, operas, and other compositions to his list throughout the years?
The opposite is true. It's a one-way street where hundreds of works that were once attributed to Mozart have been removed.
Really?
Yeah.
So the myth, even on the official level, then in one sense, is falling apart. Is that right?
Exactly, yeah. So if you look at the whole history of Mozart research, there have been more than, this is acknowledged by the Mozarteum, that more than 100 symphonies have been attributed to Mozart at various times since his death. 100. Well, today there are 41.
Yeah? Really?
And 25 of them are not by Mozart. So it goes on. No, it's a one-way street in which this 8th edition of the Kerschel catalogue will remove a further 8 pieces from that catalogue. So it's every single time, we're talking about something that is unique in the history. Imagine, if you will, an art gallery with 626 portraits hanging on the wall, and every few weeks somebody comes and removes a few because they said, well, sorry, they're not actually by Leonardo at all, they're by somebody else.
Right.
And this has been going on now for the last 150 years. It's about time for people to wake up and realize what the story is actually trying to tell them.
And when the book is out, what are your ambitions with it? What are you targeting, so to speak? Are you trying to get into the mainstream academia world here, or are you targeting more of the alternative, those who look at alternative versions of history?
No, I'm trying to speak to people who know the subject. The people who know the subject, but it hasn't... It's strange, you can be in the middle of a forest and not see the trees, no?
Yes.
And this is true of Mozart, one of the dominant myths of our civilization. Amadeus, it's what is there not to like about this? It's so enthralling, it's so childish, you know, it's so incredible. Can life continue without this? Yes, it can. Real life.
It feels like also that we're in a, and I think you touched upon this briefly before, that almost seems like many of these things now are coming to the surface, maybe not in quotes, the truth about everything, because we're still on a path where we try to discover what the truth is, but at least versions of what can be possible, and not just one single, like, this is it, you know, and nothing more. And it seems to be that we're in this time now. Would you agree on that? That things are coming to the surface?
Absolutely. We are at an age, you're so right. The 18th century was a time of tremendous human intellectual achievement. Absolutely. But our age is perhaps the greatest feature of our age is our ability to see above it. It's almost we're entering into a kind of prophetic age, or where we are able to see the track record, to judge the fruits of history, to see a recurring theme, if you like, in whatever we're examining. And how can this be so consistently said by so many people, whether it's from a musical viewpoint, a political viewpoint, a religious viewpoint? They all seem to be concurring. There seems to be a general realization that mythology and intrigue really has been so much a part of man's history.
Yes.
And it should not be relegated or suppressed from our understanding of human existence.
Is there anything here in the last couple of minutes that you would like to mention, though, that we haven't dived into, or something else that you'd like to leave people with?
Yes, I would like to say that my principal motivation is not so much to say, oh, you're wrong, but to say, look again at the discoveries of musicologists, many of them not recognized, and consider carefully the impact that has been caused by the creation of a myth, the myth being Mozart, and its cost on musicians and on culture is almost too great to quantify, I think. Mm. And for that reason alone, I think a fair and modern reassessment of this material in the light of modern discoveries is appropriate. And I hope it can be judged on that level.
Very good. And I think, again, this is really interesting material. And again, it just adds to the picture of what we're seeing now, so to speak, of how history is being, revisioned, if you will, in that sense, if you want to use that term. And
Yes. Revisionism as such is, even this term has been maligned.
Yeah, that's right.
But
yeah.
But I don't think that revisionism is a bad thing. I think
it's
rather like saying that history can only be understood by understanding queens and kings. when history is really about human people, including human nature.
Yes.
And in that sense, I encourage revisionism. I think it's the one hope we have left to come to terms with our own self and our own society.
Well, keep up the great work, Robert Newman. Thank you very much for joining us here today. And again, we would love to have you back here when your book is out and when people can get a hold of it. And maybe at that point as well, we can relay people to a website or whatnot. And you mentioned before that people can get in contact with you. Do you want to leave an email address or something like that with us that people can send you questions to? Do you have time for that?
If anyone wishes to communicate with me, I'd be grateful if you could take them. I don't really want to go into much correspondence, but if there are any important points that people send to you, please send them to me, and I would be happy to send them to them.
Further. Okay, absolutely. Okay, so people can relay that to me, and I'll relay that further to you then, Robert, maybe.
Yeah, any points at all that you feel need or would merit discussion, by all means, I'm always available for you.
Okay, very, very good. So again, thank you very much, Robert, for your time today. Great 2 hours. Very interesting hearing about the life of Mozart, about the concoction of history and how this has been put together here. But I'm looking forward to having you back then on the program here sometime after the summer, get an update, and maybe some new things that we didn't discuss this time, we can go into then as well.
Of course. I'm more than pleased. And thank you for the privilege of sharing with you.
Absolutely. Very much. Thank you, Robert. Okay, take good care.
Thank you, Henry.
Thank you for listening to our program with Robert Newman. Hope you've enjoyed it and gained some new insights, and that we've helped to add to your perspective. My thanks to Frederick behind the controls. My name is Henrik. Take good care, and we will talk more soon.